Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder now turned the investor operator. We're going to be learning a lot about building, scaling, financing, and his story is remarkable. You know, he got to work, you know, very early on at 8 years old, ladies and gentlemen. So really a spectacular journey, very inspiring, you know, career as well. And I think that you're all going to be very much enjoying the conversation today. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Richard Schenkel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So excited to be here.
So raised in Northern New Jersey. Now, give us a walk through memory lane. I know that you got to work quite early in your life. So tell us, you know, give us a little of a walk through memory lane there and how was life growing up over there?
Gosh, you're making me feel old now when I got to go down memory lane. Well, I grew up in Northern New Jersey in a town called West Orange, New Jersey. And my dad had a luncheonette in Newark, New Jersey. And at the ripe old age of 8, the expectation back in those days where we need help in our family business and got to go to work for him on Saturdays and Sundays till I was 15 years old. So I think when I look at my work ethic, well, I think it certainly was strongly influenced by him. Oh, so on that end, and now have two other siblings and grew up in a kind of a middle class type of home back then.
So you got started, you know, quite early with working, you know, at 8 years old, at 2 a.m., you know, on the weekends. I mean, that sounds wild.
Yeah, I don't think my kids would probably be very excited about doing that. I think it was a different day and era back then, that you didn't have as much choice as we give our kids today. It wasn't, I would say, Alexandro, there was no choice. It's you're going to work. And when I finished, my brothers filled in. And I think it was a typical family run business by my dad. And he needed all the help. I mean, it was a different era.
Quite early on. I mean, even at that time, when you turned 15, you were working at a different place. You know, in this case, you know, it was, I believe, what was it, like a nursing home, or what was the place where you were working at?
15, yeah, good memory there. I had left my dad's employment, which I think was a good thing, to kind of spread my wings, and went to work at a skilled nursing facility in West Orange, New Jersey, called Daughters of Israel, which ironically is still there. So, and went in there, applied for a position, and I never forgot this, at like 15, and met with what was then called the food service director and said, I'd like to know more about what it's like to work in a senior living facility. And spent a number of years working there, trying to have someone as a mentor back then to teach me things. And, you know, never regretted it. And I think that's why I wound up spending still to this day lots of time in the senior living vertical.
So at what point do you realize, because I think it was quite early on, one day I'm going to be an entrepreneur?
Oh, I will tell you, I think it's in your blood at a very young age. And I remember at the ages of 9 and 10 and 11 going out door to door, and I had a printing press in my basement. And I would print business cards, stationery, and sell it to the neighbors. And that's how I, you know, earned extra dollars. And that was one business. Then did a multitude of, then started a dry cleaning organization. I just think it's either in your blood and you're a risk taker. You can't make somebody an entrepreneur. They either want it or not. And they understand that there are no rules. There's nobody telling them what to do. They're their own boss. And they've got to have that motivation and work ethic to really do it.
So then for you, you know, you ended up going to school. You went to Wisconsin, and there you studied the food service administration. And then from there, even though you had an idea that one day you wanted to be a entrepreneur, you decided to take a different direction and you went more into the corporate world. world. I mean, that's a quite a different path to follow.
Absolutely. But I think it gives you a great backbone of experience in systems operations, culture, sophistication that fortunately for me allowed me then to break away later on with that expertise to allow me as an executive and an entrepreneur to build an organization from zero to 1 point something billion with 17,000 people as the founders and never have to relinquish or felt I had the organization outgrew me, which is very unusual for an entrepreneur. A lot of entrepreneurs get outgrown very quickly. And, you know, we've seen them in deals we've looked at recently. You know, some of them at 25 and 50 million are, you know, over their skis already, where you then need to bring in a professional CEO. So for me, I think I got the best of all worlds, academia, then corporate experience, then going out on my own and taking all that and allowing me to learn and take those best practices of what to do.
So, I mean, you did quite a bit too. I mean, whether it was in the healthcare sector or also, you know, in hospitality, you know, before you even, you know, thought about the idea of starting your own thing, no? So what were some of the things, you know, that you learned, you know, during this time, you know, about people, about, you know, the space and about business? Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, I spent a large part of my pre-entrepreneurial ventures at the Marriott Corporation. I'll tell you what I learned. A family organization is a family organization, and that's why their name was on the door. And they take it very seriously how the business operates, even as a public company. That it's just ingrained inside the organization. Number two, I think the sophistication and culture that I experienced was second to none. Never experienced it at a number of other companies, but that culture really shapes an organization of how you treat people, what the values are, what our core business is, and how we take care of the guest. Number three, I think the operational controls and financial management have got to be top priorities. Otherwise, you cannot run an organization. And number four, looking for marketplaces that had a huge amount of white space to be able to grow in. So I would look at those would be the things.
So what do you think needed to happen for you to finally activate the entrepreneurial mode?
I had been activating it even when I was working there, but in a lesser, as an investor in certain businesses and providing advice. I think when I had left one position that I'd moved to Mass for, I had always said, I need to be responsible. I think I'm bright enough to do it on my own, but I need to figure out how I'm going to build an organization and what it will be in. And ready to take the risk because it's a huge risk when you go out on your own, both from a financial, a family, and a time. And you got to understand all those things will suck the energy out of you. And I think it was right timing. I was in my 30s. And I just said, I've got to do it.
And the first time that you went at it, that was in food management. You know, you built a company around that. I mean, what was that exactly?
Well, there was a company prior to the company Unidyne that I started, a company called Republic that I had purchased in from the former founder to build it up. And, you know, it was a smaller company focused on different verticals, operating verticals. And we wound up being very, very successful, growing it to a much smaller extent and then being approached by one of the large companies where we are looking to sell it. And we did an M&A deal with another company. And it was lots of fun. You know, I can't explain it. Like to me, working hard is one thing, but working hard and having fun at the same time, that's what entrepreneurial people look for and growing people.
In your case, I mean, you had been with your prior experience in doing corporate stuff. You had looked at M&A, but I guess this was your first rodeo being on the sell side, not on M&A. So I guess, how was that experience too?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I still remember as we went through the transaction, I thirst for education. And when you do your first one, it's like doing an IPO. The first one's the toughest. The next couple get to be easier when you start doing M&A and acquisition work. And for me, it was just so much fun. Oh, and I remember reading through legal documents, which, you know, back then it was like, wow, what an education. And I thrived on it personally.
So out of all things, you know, once you're done with this food management company, you go into the dating world. I mean, that's quite the shift there of gears.
Well, you know, we had sold off that company. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I had been going through a divorce, and there was certainly voids in the late 90s in the dating world. The apps then were not like they are today. There was no way to take how you meet people having like-minded interests. And we had created a technology dating app that we thought would be very, very different than some of them on the market. But unfortunately, it's like any entrepreneur, the best idea, you still have the marketplaces dictating. And I think, as I said to you before, and in 1998, 99, 2000, if people remember, everybody, technology went out. Nobody was going to invest. The markets plummeted. Google's going away. Oh, that was when AOL was prevalent. Facebook had just, you know, launched, and Amazon was nothing more than a book company. And, you know, everybody said there won't be technology. And we look today, it's the complete opposite. Had I started that company and we had really launched into the markets, I probably wouldn't have been in the food and dining management service world again.
So then whatever happened here? Because obviously this was the segue that got you into Unity. So,
you know, it's funny. Once you launch one company or two, it's in your blood. It's something you can't explain. Like, what would start? Why, if you had one that didn't succeed, why would you start another one? And I think entrepreneurs know they're not going to be successful in every company they launch. Oh, that's an unheard track record. And I'd always seen another opportunity and always thought I would never get back in the food and dining services. But the senior living market was a very large marketplace with very few providers in the food and dining management service space with a different approach. And when we launched Unidyne officially in 2001, our approach was culture. It was all about people. It was about fresh food, which was unheard of in senior living. It was like, oh, well, why do we have to cook the food? And if you recall back in that time, that's when Whole Foods really took some grips in the market of organics and fresh food, which is only, you know, 24 years ago, approximately. So, you know, I just took it and said, we're going to launch. I'll put capital in. And let's see where it goes, and started hiring people to grow a company with no clients.
So then what happened next?
Well, in 2001, as you might remember, that was when we had our active challenges, September 11th. And that was when we had our first client come aboard, right around then. And, we just started building out the infrastructure with very few people. And we went out selling our management services to prospective clients. And I think the first year we had 5 clients by December. And then the next year we added 12 or 15. And the rest became history, that we found a very strong niche in the marketplace, in senior living, then in corporate dining, and then in healthcare. And we became a real boutique company that continued to prosper and grow. 17 when we did a transaction, and the company continues today to be out there in the marketplace at Unidyne.
What ended up being the business model of Unidyne? How were you guys making money?
So the business model, we provided food and dining management services. We were reimbursed. We would work on management fees and other fees. And basically, whether it was a profit loss arrangement or a management fee approach, we would make money.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that You know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then for you also, it's not like you raise money right away. I mean, you were funding this whole thing, you know, for the first initial years. I'm sure that was quite stressful for you.
Oh, very stressful, especially when you have a son who's going to be going to college during that time frame. But I had put enough money aside to hopefully make it. But I think what you learn as an entrepreneur, whatever you think it's going to cost, there isn't an entrepreneur who overestimates. They typically under, and I was one of those. And I guess in year five, we knew in order to grow, we were going to need some external capital, and went out in the marketplace raising capital, because part of the business model for Unidyne was to scale the business to, you know, 500 plus million. And for that, it was going to take some capital. And we raised some capital back then. And the rest became history of our growth, our boutique approach, our best in class. And the company continued to prosper. We would look for the right individuals to join. And, you know, the rest was history. So
how much did the company raise prior to the acquisition?
Oh, I think we were at the $75 million mark we had brought in capital.
And obviously the first years, as you were saying, you know, were really, really rough, you know, until you were able to really get that $75 million in place. So, you know, for the people that are listening to, how does an entrepreneur stay resilient, you know, and riding those roller coasters, especially when you are like lacking oxygen?
Yeah. You know, what I tell people, you got to take a deep breath sometimes. Nothing's straightforward. I mean, you think your revenue is going to transition to these levels, and your sales, general, and administrative costs are going to decrease. It never happens. It's the complete opposite. As a business revenue grows, there are larger requirements on your SG&A. And I think that's the learning curve you take out of it until there's that inflection point of, depending on the industry, of when the revenue exceeds your SG&A in terms of percentages, that's when you start profitable growth. And so certain business lines do not have profitable growth. Very unusual at the beginning. It's just a reality. It's you're building a business, you're not leading a business at that point.
So then in this case for you, you know, too, I mean, when we're thinking about the $75 million that you guys raised, let's talk about capital requirements here. How do you think entrepreneurs should be thinking about capital and also how much they're going to need and how to go about it?
Yeah. I think you need to do it in different rounds. I don't think, you know, to ensure that the equity is retained, the only way, in my opinion, you do it is a seed round, friends and family, a seed, then in a series A, B, C, because you're trying to drive valuation. And it's very tough with a concept to raise a heck of a lot of money. There's so many great concepts out there, and I see them come across. To me, that's almost gambling money. Because of those 10 or 15 that you look at, very few of them ever get to fruition. Oh, they start, they don't have the burning in the belly. Everybody thinks it's easy. And then they realize, wow, this is not so easy. And I think you need to overestimate your capital needs, but do it in phases, would be my recommendation.
So then in your case, eventually the acquisition happened. You know, obviously you were writing this for 21 years, I mean, close to 22 years. At what point does it become evident that it's time to turn chapter?
You know, we had one other major shareholder, and I knew it was kind of timing in the market. Like, there's never, you know, I tell people, if you think you're going to catch the upside, if you knew that, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. And the years had grown. We had a lot of inquiries, and we then brought in our investment bank in 2016 and 17. And it was just a very strong marketplace, both in private equity and strategics. And we just felt it was the right time. We were at the right inflection point. And there was never any mention of the people leaving. It wasn't like we were going to do an M&A deal, whether it's strategic or financial, and everybody would be leaving, that people were going to stay on. And especially if it was going to be a financial buyer, it was going to be a requirement. If it was a strategic, I think we had a little more flexibility. And Alexandra, I can't tell you that we thought it was the best time, but I think 17 was a really strong year. And it was just timing. Oh, and some of it's luck, you know, being in the right place at the right time.
100%. So obviously, 9-figure exit. So that was pretty amazing. Now, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So instead of launching another company, you decided to join another one, you know, before what we're going to be talking about now, which is what you guys are up to with Phoenix 3 Holdings. But why joining another operation?
Yeah, when I joined Compass, which was the acquirer that we did our strategic acquisition with, and stayed on because I care about our people. I had selected most of them. Culture was always important to me, and I would interview almost the majority of the exempt corporately. I interviewed everybody who was in it. I just think it sets the culture when the founder interviews. And at Compass, we had certain requirements as part of our alliance with them. And we just grew that business even under Compass. And it was a lot of fun.
How many people did you have at the time of the acquisition?
Oh, at the time, I think we had 6,000 to 7,000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So wow. It was a very large enterprise. Remember, we were a distributed employee type of operation. So think of Unidyne as a restaurant company with 200 or 300 locations. So very strong with a decentralized workforce. And at Compass, we wound up growing three organizations internally that we put together, that I created. And when I left in 2022, I think we were tracking at $1.3 billion, and I think it was 15,000 plus employees. So a very large enterprise. But I think what you realize as an entrepreneur, you're not an entrepreneur at those numbers. You just can't be. And I love being an entrepreneur and watching things grow. It's kind of like planting a seed and watching it grow. It's a lot of fun watching people grow, watching the company aspire and hit those needs, and also how you lead and manage the clients as well. It's very different.
So talk to us about culture. What would you say? Because obviously that's a lot of people, you know, and I'm sure that you guys, you know, were really careful about culture. What would you say are the three key components of a successful culture?
Number one, defining it correctly, what it is. And I happen to write all of the culture because as a founder, it was my organization. And we had done that in the first couple of years of the company. I did it. So I think, number one, what is the culture? I think number two is how you're going to permeate that organization with the culture. I've worked at many companies even prior where they gave a wallet card and said, here's our culture. That was the mention of it. That's not culture. Culture is something that has to be practiced every minute of the day by your associates, team members, whatever the word is. And it has to be front of mind. And, you know, what we realized immediately, Unidyne, it had to be practiced by all the hourly team members as well, day to day. They had to buy into it, understand it, and it had to permeate the organization twice a day in a formalized setting. It's kind of like I use the analogy, the Pledge of Allegiance. The Pledge of Allegiance doesn't go away. You may say, I know it now, but you just kept using it. And I think culture is the identical thing. And we had a whole process of things people would have to do to understand it. And I think the third thing for any organization is selecting the people, not just on technical skill, but on culture fit. I have seen so many times you might have the brightest person in a role, but they are the wrong cultural fit. They're not an entrepreneur. They don't value, their work ethic isn't at the level. And if those are requirements of the culture, you can't deviate. You just can't. And I think that's where a lot of organizations fall down as they grow, because they put it to the side. Oh, and I think the last part is culturally growing with the right clients. You know, at the end of the day, our business was about clients and the guest. And if we didn't select the right client or the right type of market that we wanted to play in, it was not a good culture fit. And I think when you've put all those things together, you just can accelerate the growth of that organization.
And obviously quite the acceleration, you know, from zero to 400 million, not bad, you know, nine figure exit. So after you do that integration, you know, after you worked with Compass, making sure that everyone was taken care of, then you decide that it's time to go at it again. And that was with Phoenix Three Holdings. So what are you guys doing at Phoenix Three Holdings?
Wow. Great question. We're having a lot of fun. You know, we've got about 15 or 18 people working with us right now. We've got one company we've made a major investment in, Infuse Hospitality out in Chicago, who is an on-site food and dining service company focused on the commercial market, as well as Fairgrounds Coffee, where we're helping that organization grow in the markets they play in. We've got a couple of new co's that we're funding as well that'll get be out there in the near future with great founders. And, you know, we look at different investments in senior living, healthcare and business services and distributed service companies or lifestyle companies where we feel we can make a difference by our expertise of operating people, as well as, by the way, we have capital to invest in typically founder or family-based organizations to help them grow and avoid the pitfalls of what other entrepreneurs go through.
And I believe that the capital under management is about 100 million. So I guess when you guys get involved with companies, I mean, what's the ideal profile of a company?
Under 100 million must be have, you know, 10 million plus of revenue. So that's a big range. Must be approaching positive EBITDA or have a plan. Has to have sticky revenue. Has to have strong retention in the marketplace, must be family or founder based. And the number one thing we look for, honestly, is culture fit. You know by walking in the door what culture is like. It's kind of ingrained in you. And when our team works with that other team, if we see it's so dysfunctional, we're not there to change dysfunction. We're there to help improve results. And if it's not the right team, we won't invest in it. So those are the major criteria.
Imagine you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Phoenix Three Holdings is fully realized. What does that world look like?
That the company we invested in has started its acceleration, high growth of 30, 40% a year, retention of the founder, and growing that founder. And that company becomes a boutique company as the best in class in its industry.
So now let's talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say I bring you back in time. You know, I bring you back in time to the moment where you are now, you know, let's say about to launch, let's say Unidyne, you know, back in 2001. Let's say you're able to have a chat with that younger self, that younger Richard, and you're able to give that younger Richard one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
It would be have enough capital to hire the best people that are overqualified to begin the journey with you.
I love that. So, Richard, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Oh, they can send me an email to rschenkel at phx3.com. They can go to the Phoenix 3 website, which is phx3.com, and there's a contact us. And happy to have any opportunities that are presented or even any questions to help them grow. It would be my pleasure.
Well, easy enough. Well, Richard, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us today.
Well, an honor to be with you as well, and have a great holiday weekend and enjoy. And thank you for your time, too.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.